The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzmann presiding before court number 21-00246, Asan Aluminum versus the United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Good morning, Your Honor. John Herman with Kelly Bryan Warren on behalf of the Aluminum Association Common Alloy Sheet Trade Enforcement Working Group and its individual members.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's quite a mouthful.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kyle Beckridge on behalf of the United States. Here with me, I have Ashlyn Gellin, Counsel for Commerce.
Morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Leah Scarpelli with Aaron Fox Schitt here on behalf of Asan.
Good morning. Please be seated. Counsel are in receipt. I know of the letter sent by the court on January 18th, setting forth questions for oral argument. Of course, there may be more questions. And you each know that the time allotments will be 15 minutes for the plaintiffs, 15 minutes for the government, and 15 minutes for the defendant interveners, also known as the consolidated plaintiffs. And as happens in the fascinating world of our cases, there are often several arguments, sifting positions, sifting allegiances. There's no perfect sequence, of course, but as we have presented the order of questions, we're going to follow the order of questions, but recognizing that, you know, your best friend on one issue may not be your best friend on another issue. And also, I will tell the parties in advance, and as you all know, you've all appeared in front of me before, give the parties an opportunity post-argument to file a submission, and we'll see how the argument goes, but I think it will probably be somewhat longer word count than usual because realize that for the oral argument, we do not request answers in writing. So without further ado, we will begin with the questions as set forth in the letter of January 18th for the beginning with the plaintiff. And of course, you know, you are free to make an opening statement.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. For the record, again, this is Leah Scarpelli on behalf of Asan. I'm just going to dive right into questions given the time constraints. So your first question is what we intend to be the legal effect of our statements regarding AFA. So to clarify, Asan disagrees with Commerce's application of an adverse inference with respect to Asan's reported billing adjustments. Asan is not waiving this argument and accordingly briefed in its comments on the remand redetermination to Commerce and to the court on this issue. In the event that an appeal to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is ultimately required, Asan preserves the right to raise this issue on appeal. That being said, Asan is primarily interested in an expeditious opinion sustaining Commerce's remand results. Because the net effect of Commerce's remand redetermination is the calculation of a de minimis margin for Asan, we're not requesting an additional remand as a remedy for this issue. Should the court sustain these results of Commerce's remand redetermination, Asan will no longer be subject to the anti-dumping order on common alloy aluminum sheet from Turkey. I'll address your next two questions together. You first ask whether we agree with the Aluminum Association's assertion that we've waived our challenge, and then if so, if that waiver would extend to future remand proceedings in this case. So as I noted, ASAN is not requesting a second remand on this issue in the interest of an efficient resolution of the matter. Though we're not requesting a second remand, we are not waiving the argument for any subsequent appeal. ASAN briefed this issue in its comments to Commerce and to the court, and is preserving the argument in any further appeal to the Federal Circuit if necessary. Moving to your second question and shifting to the drawback issue, you first ask whether there are U.S.-bound exports of subject merchandise that were made pursuant to other IPCs other than the closed IPC. In Exhibit C-10 of ASAN's initial Section C response dated June 29, 2020, ASAN provided screenshots from the Turkish Customs IPR portal that shows the last 15 certificates used. This documentation shows ASAN's use of four IPCs during the period of investigation, which is also consistent with ASAN's reporting the Section C response. One of the four certificates is the closed IPC that Commerce used to calculate the per unit adjustment in this case. The other three certificates did not meet Commerce's definition of closed at the time ASAN filed its Section C response and were not included in the calculation of Commerce's per unit adjustment. However, as shown in Exhibit C-10, all four certificates were active during the period of investigation and had expired by the time ASAN filed its Section C response, such that additional imports and exports under those certificates were no longer possible. Every U.S. export was made pursuant to one of those four IPCs. There's no specific trace between imported inputs under a specific IPC and exports of subject merchandise to the United States on the record in this investigation, such that we can definitively say which U.S.-bound exports of subject merchandise were made pursuant to which of the four IPCs. You next ask, why a separate per unit adjustment should not apply to sales under separate IPCs. We're not aware of any case where Commerce has applied separate per unit adjustments to separate sales, and information, as I mentioned, is not available on the record to do so in this case. Commerce has consistently held that the two-prong test does not require a material input to exported merchandise specific link between the imports on which the duties are exempted or refunded and the exports that generate the duty drawback benefit. As such, Commerce did not request that the IPC number be provided for each U.S. sale.
And then when you present Commerce's practice, what is it, the case that best articulates that?
So this Commerce's practice has evolved over time. I think that the cases mm-hmm. that best articulate it are at the Commerce level, so that would be steel concrete reinforcing bar from Turkey. The citation is 86 Federal Register 28574. And also the first administrative review in this case, common alloy aluminum sheet from Turkey. That's dated November 13, 2023, and the citation is 88 Federal Register 77550, and ASAN is also a mandatory respondent in that case.
And those sites are in your filings?
I believe that the CAS, the first results of the administrative review in CAS was after our initial briefing, but I believe the citation is in our comments on remand.
Thank you.
So as I mentioned, we're not aware of any cases where Commerce has applied a separate per unit adjustment to separate sales, and the information is not available to do so here. But Commerce has consistently held that the two-prong test does not require the link that that we would need to link inputs to exports, and that information was thus not requested. So ASAN's reporting and Commerce's application of a single per unit adjustment is consistent with the requirements of the Turkish drawback law, which also doesn't require that imported inputs under an IPC be linked to specific exports under the same IPC, nor to specific U.S. sales to qualify for the drawback adjustment. The Turkish drawback system is not limited to U.S. exports, and IPCs are not issued pursuant to anti-dumping investigations such that their parameters are an exact match to the period of investigation or to the scope of an AD case. As in all investigations, the IPCs used by Asan in the normal course of business are not limited to the time period covered by this investigation, to subject merchandise, or to U.S. exports. To account for these differences, Commerce applies its two-pronged test to determine whether they're eligible for drawback and then calculates a per-unit adjustment, which is applied only to U.S. sales of subject merchandise during the period of investigation. The fact that there were exports to other countries under the same Turkish IPC is irrelevant because the calculated per-unit adjustment is applied only to Asan's U.S. sales. To try to make the terms of a Turkish IPC match the terms of this investigation by eliminating certain imports or exports used to close the IPC from the per-unit calculation leads to mismatches between the numerator and the denominator. If only U.S. exports are included in the denominator, the numerator, which includes all inputs used to produce exports under the IPC, would also have to be adjusted. That would require tracing between inputs and exports. If petitioners object to the coverage of the IPC used to calculate the per-unit adjustment, their issue is with Commerce's requirement that only closed IPCs having received official approval documentation from the government of Turkey be used in the per-unit calculation. The fact that Commerce limited its per-unit calculation to only one IPC does not change the fact that four IPCs were used during the period, nor that every export was made pursuant to an IPC. Your next question deals with Utem Galva and the relevance of that case here. So as I stated, petitioner's proposal to use U.S. exports as the denominator in the per-unit calculation would require tracing to determine the import inputs used to produce those exports to ensure that the numerator and denominator are proportional. Here, because there are four IPCs used, that would include inputs under four different IPCs to get to a proportional number with the exports. Utem Galva also clarified that the drawback statute requires that export price be adjusted based on the entire drawback that occurred by reason of exportation of subject merchandise to the United States, without an additional requirement that imported inputs actually be incorporated into goods sold in the U.S. Commerce's two-pronged test only requires that there are sufficient imports of the raw material to account for the duty drawback on the exports of the subject merchandise. This court has already found in its March 1st, 2023 opinion that Commerce's general grant of a duty drawback adjustment to Asan accords with law because the inputs under the closed IPC were potentially capable of producing finished casts, and there were enough of them to account for the duty drawback on exports. Consistent with Utem Galva, Commerce's calculation of Asan's duty drawback adjustment in the remand redetermination best reflects the duties actually exempted for the exports of subject merchandise made to the United States during the period of investigation. As articulated by the Federal Circuit in Saha Thai, which is 635 F3D 1335, the goal is to increase export price to the level it would be absent the duty drawback, which could otherwise lead to an inaccurately high dumping margin. Commerce's calculation in the remand redetermination fulfills the statutory purpose of the duty drawback provision by eliminating, to the extent possible, any effect of the Turkish drawback system on the dumping calculations. Petitioner's proposed calculation, on the other hand, would severely limit the adjustment to only a small portion of Asan's U.S. sales, capturing only a fraction of the drawback Asan actually received. Petitioner's proposal is therefore inconsistent with Utem Galva's requirement that Commerce consider the full extent of the duty drawback, Saha Thai's requirement that export price be increased to the level it would be absent duty drawback, and the statute's requirement that Commerce adjust U.S. price by the amount of import duties which have been rebated or which have not been collected. Your next question involves the definition of tracing, which can be a complex term in this context. But assemblies in this context, tracing refers to tracking a particular imported input to a U.S. export and ultimately to a U.S. sale. Tracing an imported input through production and entry to a specific sale is not required because the Turkish government credits the drawback to the quantity of goods that were in fact exported, whatever the source of the inputs used to produce them. You next ask,
what's your best case for that proposition?
Udungalva is the best case regarding tracing. If there are different types of tracing, you next ask which types the Federal Circuit has rejected. So again, Udungalva deals with the tracing of particular imported goods to U.S. exports, and it rejected the proposition that that was required to grant a duty drawback adjustment. An extension of the tracing rejected in Udungalva would be tracing a specific imported input through export to a specific U.S. sale. Commerce only requires that there are sufficient imports of the raw material input to account for the drawback on exports as part of its two-prong test. And again, the two-prong test was recognized in Sahatai by the Federal Circuit and has been recognized by this court in several other cases. The realized consumption tables for the closed IPC provide the necessary link under the Turkish IPR system sufficient to satisfy the second prong of commerce's two-prong test. Here, a listing of which U.S. sales of subject merchandise were made pursuant to which of the four IPCs active during the period of investigation was not requested and is not on the record in this case. He next asked on what authority do we base our contention that a petitioner failed to exhaust its argument raised in the first time in the remand redetermination. In Next Steel versus United States, the citation for that is 461 F sub 3D 1336. In that case, the Court of International Trade found that a party had waived its argument with respect to an issue when it did not raise it in the administrative case brief and instead raised it for the first time in its comments on a draft remand redetermination. The court specifically held that the party failed to exhaust its administrative remedies because it was aware of the issue after the preliminary determination, it failed to raise the issue in the initial administrative case brief, and it challenged Commerce's determination for the first time in its comments on the second remand redetermination. Here, despite the duty drawback calculation being in dispute throughout this proceeding, petitioners did not raise arguments regarding the allocation of the per unit drawback adjustment or any other arguments related to the volume of exports under the closed IPC during the briefing stage before Commerce, nor in briefing to this court. Additionally, Commerce's regulations require that it reject untimely filed new factual information unless the record is reopened or an extension is sought. Factual information includes, among other things, data in support of allegations. In this case, Commerce did not reopen the record on remand for additional information. The petitioners nevertheless provided a new drawback calculation as an attachment to its May 18, 2023 comments on remand submitted to Commerce, which were then cited extensively in its subsequent submission of comments with this court. In Tri-Union Frozen Products, which is 163 F sub 3D 1255, the CIT found that a calculation based on information that was already part of the administrative record was new factual information. And in another Next Deal case, this one is 392 F sub 3D 1276, Commerce found a proposed reallocation of G&A expenses to be new factual information not previously on the record, again, even though that proposed calculation was based on record information. Like a G&A calculation, a duty drawback calculation would similarly constitute data and be new factual information under Commerce's regulation. And I see I'm running out of time, so quickly, I've already flagged the two cases, steel concrete reinforcing bar and common alloy aluminum sheet from Turkey at the Commerce level, which best support our overall argument. In addition, I'll also flag a pending case before this court, CIT number 21616, which is the appeal of aluminum foil from Turkey in which Assan is also a mandatory respondent. In that case, petitioner, the Commerce originally did the same calculation that petitioners are proposing here, but requested a voluntary remand to align its calculation with subsequent cases. And the calculation that it would be aligning with is what it used in this remand redetermination.
What is the status of that in the case you just cited?
Briefing is completed, and we're expecting a determination in the first quarter of this year.
Is that on appeal for the Federal Circuit?
No, it's before this court.
Before this court?
Yes.
And that's,
before Judge Baden, I believe. Yes.
Thanks. So there's an argument on that case?
There has.
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Just so the parties know, I will allow you a little time for rebuttal, 5 minutes each. So you have an opportunity to respond to what you're hearing this morning. Thank you. For the government, Mr. Beckridge.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The Court should sustain Commerce's remand redetermination because it's supported by substantial evidence in accordance with law. I think there's really two questions before the Court. First, did Commerce reasonably calculate the per unit amount, the ratio that is applied to Assan's U.S. sales? The second question is, could Commerce apply that ratio to all of Assan's U.S. sales? The answer to both questions is that Commerce reasonably conducted its methodology. With respect to calculating the per unit amount, in order to calculate an amount that provides the full extent of the duty drawback, Commerce had to consider the full amount exempted under the closed IPC and divide that by the full amount of exports under the closed IPC. To consider a different universe of exports as the denominator would insert variables that would not reflect the full extent of the duty drawback adjustment.
So what is your home run case for that proposition?
The proposition of the full extent of the duty drawback must be granted?
Right.
I think that the Utomgala case is clear on that Commerce must grant the full extent of the duty drawback. And I think that gets to the second question. So how should Commerce apply that per unit ratio? And the answer is it should apply to all of Assan's U.S. sales for the reason that Counsel for Assan stated. All of Assan's U.S. exports were subject to an IPC. It's just that three of them remained open and thus could not be used under Commerce's practice to calculate the per unit amount. So Commerce uses the closed IPC to calculate the ratio, the per unit amount, and then applies that to all of the sales subject to an IPC because all of those sales will result in a duty drawback adjustment or will result in an exemption of liability under Turkish law. And so in order to effectuate the Federal Circuit's mandate under under UTOM, which is stated in the statute, to give the full extent of the duty drawback, that per unit ratio has to be applied to all of Assan's U.S. sales. I'll turn to Your Honor's questions now. First, Your Honor asked how the government defines tracing. Broadly speaking, tracing is connecting factual statements or assertions with supportive source documentation. So in the context of a duty drawback, again, where the Federal Circuit has held that a respondent need not trace imported goods to U.S. exports, we understand that requirement means that a respondent need not prove that a particular import was actually used in an export in order to calculate the drawback adjustment. And as Counsel for Assan stated, that requirement is consistent with the Turkish program, which likewise does not require showing that inputs were actually included in particular exports. Second, Your Honor asked whether the closure of the IPC at issue in this case depended on non-U.S. bound exports, and if so, whether Commerce's methodology impermissibly accounts for duties forgiven by reason of exportation to foreign countries other than the United States. And so to answer your first question, yes, the closure of the IPC at issue did depend on non-U.S. bound exports. But the reason that the methodology is not problematic in spite of that fact is because, again, the statute requires that Commerce make an adjustment to the full extent of the duty drawback. But what Commerce did here was not apply the aggregate of the duty drawback to Assange U.S. sales. Instead, Commerce applied a per-unit duty drawback benefit. Commerce takes the full amount of the duty forgiven and divides it by the total amount of exports under the closed IPC. Again, that creates a per-unit amount that accounts for the full extent of the duty drawback that can then be applied to all of Assange U.S. sales. And relatedly, the court proposes a hypothetical where U.S. exports only represented 0.1% of exports under the IPC. And the court asked whether it would be consistent with the statute for Commerce to attribute a per-unit adjustment resulting from that IPC to all U.S. sales during the period of review and whether doing so would be reasonable. And I think this question really gets to the heart of the case. And the answer to both of the questions is yes. That would be consistent with the statute, and that would be reasonable. As long as the IPC is closed during the period of investigation and it reflects exports to the United States, Commerce is able to rely on that closed IPC to calculate the duty drawback adjustment no matter how small the percentage of U.S.-bound exports. And that's because Commerce is calculating a per-unit amount, a ratio that can be applied to U.S. sales. So the fact that there are far fewer U.S. sales just means that the total amount of the duty drawback adjustment would be smaller, but the per-unit amount itself would not be problematic. And this is consistent with the statute because it still accounts for the full extent of the duty drawback, which the Federal Circuit has held is required. And it's also reasonable because to apply that per-unit amount to all U.S. sales for the reason that I stated at the beginning, and that's because all of Assange's exports were shipped pursuant to an IPC. It's just that three of those IPCs remained open. But it's reasonable for Commerce to assume that those IPCs will eventually be closed and that Assange would thus receive an exemption of liability for those imported inputs under those other IPCs. So in order to give the full effect of the drawback, Commerce had to apply the per unit amount to the full extent of Assange U.S. sales. And in fact, to limit the application of that per unit amount, the ratio, to only sales made during the IPC, would assume that all of Assange's other sales would not benefit from a drawback. But that assumption would not give full effect to the drawback provided by Turkey, and thus would run contrary to the statute. Next, Your Honor notes that the association hypothesizes that if Assange had hypothetically doubled its U.S. sales during the period of investigation, the agency would have granted a duty drawback adjustment in an amount that is greater than the total amount of duty liability that the Turkish government actually exempted under the closed IPC. The court asked if that's true, and if it is true, whether that's a problematic and in contravention of the statute. I don't think we have enough information to say definitively whether that would be true. I think it would depend on whether those sales had an impact on the closed IPC and the amount of duties exempted under that IPC. But assuming that those sales had no impact on the closed IPC and the amount extinguished under the IPC, it is theoretically possible that the amount of the adjustment could exceed the amount of exempted liability under the IPC. But to answer your question, that is not problematic or in contravention of the statute. Again, all of Assange U.S. exports were subject to an IPC, but because they remained open, Commerce could not rely on them to calculate the per-unit amount. So instead, Commerce relied on the closed IPC, relied on the consumption ratios in the closed IPC to calculate the per-unit amount because that was the evidence it had available. The total amount of the drawback adjustment might be greater than the amount exempted under the closed IPC does not mean that the total amount of the adjustment is greater than the full extent of the drawback granted by Turkey. Again, that's because some of the IPCs remained open during the period of investigation, and so Commerce cannot determine whenever it is making its determination precisely what the amount of exempted liability is from Turkey. So it used the best evidence it had available, the consumption ratios within the closed IPC. But again, the fact that the amount of the drawback adjustment exceeded the liability exempted under one closed IPC does not mean that it exceeded the full extent of the drawback granted by Turkey. Your Honor asked whether 19 U.S.C. section 1677A C1B is ambiguous as it pertains to this case. and whether the court owes deference to Commerce's interpretation of that provision. And we do not believe the statute is ambiguous or that the court need to defer to Commerce's interpretation. Again, in Utom Gobble Stills, the Federal Circuit held that the plain reading of the statute requires an adjustment to the export price based on the full extent of the duty drawback. Here, Commerce's methodology accounts for the duty drawback benefit in its entirety by using that benefit and calculating the per unit amount, the per unit ratio that should be applied, and then applying that ratio to all of its assigned U.S. sales. Next, the court asked whether the government takes a position as to whether Assan has waived any challenge to Commerce's application of an adverse inference based on its reporting of billing adjustments, and if so, whether that waiver would apply to future remand proceedings. And the government does not take a position as to whether Assan has waived its challenge to Commerce's application of adverse inference. Although we don't believe that issue is before the court today, that's because Commerce's remand redetermination resulted in a de minimis margin for Assan, and the remand determination would thus result in the revocation of the order if it's sustained by the court. Finally,
so again, just to be clear, so if Assan had waived such a challenge, would that waiver extend to future remand proceedings, in your view?
If Assan waived, I suppose if Assan had waived it, but again, we're not taking the position that Assan has.
I understand that.
Yeah. But if Assan had waived its challenge, I think that would extend to future remand proceedings. And finally, Your Honor asked whether there are any recent or pending Federal Circuit or CIT cases that may affect the court's analysis. And we would also point the court to case number 21-616, which is the same case that Assan's counsel pointed Your Honor to. It's the case on which we understand that the petitioner is proposing that the Commerce should have adopted the methodology from. And in that case, we requested a voluntary remand to reconsider the methodology. So we certainly don't think that would be a reason for the court to overturn Commerce's remand redetermination here. If the court has no further questions, we ask that the court sustain Commerce's remand redetermination.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from the defendant intervening or the consolidated plaintiffs.
Yes, I guess depending on which caption of the case you're looking at. Good morning, Your Honor. John Herman with Kelly Dry and Warren again for the record. Appearing on behalf of the consolidated plaintiff / defendant intervener. I'm just going to jump right into the questions. You've obviously thought a lot about this. I want to make sure we're responsive, and I'll save a couple additional points for rebuttal. With respect to your first question, if I'm understanding it correctly, I think respectfully it's premised on a circumstance that is not correct. As I believe I heard Ms. Scarpelli say, under the Turkish inward processing regime, the destination of a particular export is irrelevant. So there is nothing specific about an export to the United States that would be required to close an inward processing certificate. Exports can go anywhere so long as they leave Turkey. And I think more fundamentally, so long as the requirements of the statute and Commerce's practice are met, a drawback adjustment is appropriate. And just to review those, you have to have a closed IPC. That has been upheld by the Court of International Trade, not you, Your Honor, but the CIT generally, on several occasions. And then under the statute, there has to be an amount of duty that's rebated. It has to relate to subject merchandise, and it has to involve an export to the United States. Those are the requirements for a drawback, and I think are relevant to the court's analysis. With respect to your second question or sub-question, I guess I should say, would the answer change if there were a very large percentage of exports to the United States under a closed IPC? The answer is still the same. Under that scenario, it seems like based on the hypothetical you've set up, the requirements for drawback would be satisfied. If you've got a closed IPC, an amount of duty that's rebated involving subject merchandise that's exported to the United States. With respect to your second question on tracing, I think we generally agree with the explanation of tracing that was laid out by Asan. Tracing under the Federal Circuit's decision in Utamgalva is the process of tying a specific imported good to a specific exported good. So in other words, is this imported ingot traced through the production process and used in producing a coil that is exported and subject to drawback? We agree that Utamgalva stands for the proposition that tracing is not required, but tracing is irrelevant to our argument. Tracing is really relevant to what goes into the numerator, right? It goes to the quantity of duties that is rebated. Our arguments go to the allocation of that amount across the sales database that the respondent has identified. Indeed, the record before the Commerce Department, as I think other parties have said this morning, wouldn't support tracing. The information simply isn't on the record. Yet, if you look at the Commerce Department's remand redetermination, it's replete with references to tracing. Our argument is not based on tracing, and we're a little puzzled why the Commerce Department's remand redetermination basically characterizes our argument as being based on the tracing methodology. That simply isn't the case and demonstrates that the analysis underlying the Commerce Department's remand redetermination is incorrect. With respect to the sub-question here, again, unless I'm misunderstanding something, I guess I'd go back to the point I was making earlier, which is under Utamgalva, tracing is irrelevant, either to determining eligibility for drawback or for calculating the benefit. The statute doesn't require that the drawback adjustment be limited to subject merchandise and to exports to the United States, but that's not the tracing that the Utamgalva decision is addressing. With respect to your third question concerning Commerce's rejection of our proposed alternative methodology, and how that relates to the standard of review that this court applies. As addressed in our papers, we think the court should remand the Commerce Department's redetermination because it's not supported by substantial evidence and it's not in accordance with law. Regarding the rejection of our proposed alternative, Commerce's analysis is incorrect there too. Commerce asserts incorrectly that our proposed alternative is based on tracing. Again, that's flatly incorrect and demonstrates another basis for this court sending the redetermination back to the agency. Our papers make clear that our position is that we're not requesting the court direct a result. And frankly, we can conceive of two methodologies that would satisfy the statute here. One would involve the Commerce Department's calculation of a drawback methodology based on the amount of drawback paid under closed IPCs divided by the value of the sales that are subject to those IPCs. And that adjustment would be applied just to the relevant sales. Alternatively, we can also envision a methodology by the Commerce Department that would consider the amount of drawback paid pursuant to closed IPCs divided by the entire database for Asan, but that would have to be applied to all sales. You get different quantums of adjustment that need to be married up to be consistent with the way that they're ultimately applied to the database. There may be other methodologies that the Commerce Department could come up with on remand that would be lawful under the requirements of the statute. We don't want to preclude that or foreclose that. But the bottom line is that the methodology that the Commerce Department has applied in the remand redetermination is unlawful, and it should be remanded so that the Commerce Department can come up with a lawful methodology and can come up with a basis for explaining its decision that isn't premised on tracing, which is irrelevant here. In terms of authorities that best support our argument, I guess I'd start with several. One fundamental consideration, which Mr. Beckrich was just discussing, is the requirement that drawback be based on a closed IPC. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, that issue has been addressed and has been consistently affirmed by the Court of International Trade in a decision short form of Habas. The citation there is 439 F sub 3rd, 1342. That was a decision by Chief Judge Barnett in 2020. There have also been two more recent decisions, both issued by Judge Rustani. The first is ICDAS. It's CIT slip op 23-124. That was decided on August 23rd of 2023. The other decision by Judge Rustani is Knoxell, CIT slip op 23-125, also decided on August 23rd, 2023. Assan has not challenged the Commerce Department's requirement that an IPC be closed in order for a drawback adjustment to be made, and that issue has not gone before the CAFC, but we believe is widely affirmed here by this court generally.
Is that an issue?
No, I don't think it is. I just wanted to emphasize that, you know, it is an important requirement, and it is relevant to the manner in which the Commerce Department calculated the adjustment that was ultimately applied here. The next authority that I would identify in support of our argument is the statute. The statute clearly sets out the requirements for a drawback adjustment. There must be duties that are rebated or not collected. They must be involved or tied to subject merchandise, and they must involve shipments to the United States. And I guess the last authority that I will cite for your honor here is a decision by the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, Nanya Plastics Corp. versus United States. The citation is 810 F3rd 1333. The pin site is 1344. It was a decision issued in 2016. And the relevance of that decision relates to the ultimate application of the drawback adjustment by the Commerce Department and the fact that it must be mathematically correct. And the portion of the court's, the CAFC's decision that I think is particularly relevant states, our case law and the statute thus teach that a commerce determination is accurate if it is correct as a mathematical and factual matter, thus supported by substantial evidence. I think for the reasons outlined in our brief, the Commerce Department's methodology misapplies the drawback that was calculated based on closed IPCs to all sales and therefore results in an improperly large amount of drawback relative to what should be applied based on the information that was submitted by Assan. In terms of recent pending CAFC or CIT cases that may affect the court's analysis, this issue has not reached the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. I think this case is obviously the lead case where this issue has been raised. As has been mentioned previously, this issue is before the court generally in two other actions. The first is Assan's appeal of the Commerce Department's anti-dumping investigation on foil from Turkey. Again, the court number for that matter is CIT court number 21 21-00616. It's a case before Judge Vaden. As discussed previously, the Commerce Department, or I guess the Justice Department, I should say, did request a voluntary remand in that matter. Judge Vaden did not automatically grant that request and requested that the parties submit supplemental briefing on whether a voluntary remand is appropriate in that matter. We, not surprisingly, took the position that a voluntary remand is not appropriate and is not needed in that matter because the Commerce Department's methodology in that underlying proceeding is supported by substantial evidence and in accordance with law. As indicated, briefing is complete on that matter, and it's before Judge Vaden for advisement, and we'll see whether the judge decides to grant a voluntary remand or not in that matter.
That was a case where the government sought a voluntary remand?
Correct.
Okay, as you've noted, your client opposed it.
We opposed it. That's exactly right.
Was there any party that also endorsed the idea of a voluntary remand?
I think it's fair to say Hassan also would support
in that case.
Yes, Hassan is also involved in that case. Yeah. They were the respondent in the foil investigation, mm-hmm. as opposed to the aluminum sheet investigation at issue here. And then the other matter I wanted to draw to Your Honor's attention is that it's not been assigned yet, but on behalf of the Aluminum Association, we have filed an appeal challenging the Commerce Department's final results in the first administrative review issued under the same aluminum sheet order that's at issue in this case. We filed a summons and a complaint. A Form 24 statutory injunction was just entered the other day. The case has not been assigned yet, but the case caption there is CIT Court Number 23-00251. And as the court will see from our complaint, the sole issue that we've raised in that case is the appropriateness of the Commerce Department's drawback adjustment as applied to Hassan in the first administrative review. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, but otherwise I think I'll simply raise some additional issues in rebuttal or closing.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
So the plan is that the court will allocate 5 minutes per side for rebuttal. Ms. Gartelli, for the plaintiff.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, for the record, this is Leah Scarpelli on behalf of Hassan. So I'll start first with the idea of the closed IPCs. I think the only relevance that issue has is that petitioners object to the representativeness of the closed IPC as compared to all the other open IPCs in this case. So in that case, their issue is with the fact that the closed IPC is what's used to calculate the per unit adjustment. There's been no case addressing the closed IPC issue in terms of which sales the drawback actually gets applied to. It's only for purposes of the calculation of the per unit adjustment that the closed IPC issue has come up. And I would just note that the Habash case that petitioners counsel cited, that case was before Commerce has the definition of closed that it does now, so that case isn't really relevant. And in the ICDOSH case, no drawback adjustment was granted at all because there wasn't a closed IPC, so those cases aren't particularly relevant. I'd next turn to the fact that the difference between the open and closed IPCs in terms of how relevant they are in terms of the drawback actually received. So we're talking about the closed IPC, but there were actually four IPCs, and the volume under those four IPCs is what is the full amount of the drawback received. Even though the per unit adjustment is limited to one closed IPC, it doesn't change the fact that there were full four IPCs used, and that is the full extent of the drawback granted by Turkey. Next, I would point out that Turkey's drawback system functions independently from U.S. anti-dumping laws. That's the reason why Commerce has this two-pronged test to determine eligibility. And here, Asan satisfied that test. They showed that their inputs were capable of producing CAF. They also showed that there were exports to the U.S. under the closed IPC, and they even provided a trace in Exhibit V6 of the verification response filed on December 18th. Asan provided two invoices for two transactions under the closed IPC and identified those sales in its sales database. Next, I would point out Petitioner's counsel is correct that the per-unit calculation has to be mathematically correct. And to be mathematically correct, a numerator and a denominator need to be consistent. There's no way to have a consistent numerator without tracing. Petitioner suggests that there be a numerator tied to a single IPC and a denominator tied to four IPCs. Obviously, that mathematically just doesn't work. And then it's also hard to see how the application of the per unit adjustment to only specific sales, as petitioner proposes in its second methodology, would not involve tracing. And finally, I'll just note that Asan has already been prejudiced by the delay in this proceeding caused by petitioner's unusual request for this second oral argument on remand determination. As petitioner's counsel noted, in the 3 years this appeal has been pending, Asan has fully participated in the first administrative review, which is now also on appeal to the court, and the second administrative review, which has started, and Asan has again filed questionnaire responses that remains in progress. Asan's costly participation in these proceedings will be completely moot if Commerce's remand redetermination is sustained and Asan is excluded from the anti-dumping duty order. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but we request that the remand redetermination be sustained.
The latter point, that refers to the other litigation?
The litigation that's pending on the first administrative review of this order.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just so that I'm clear in my own mind, you referenced the parties have all referenced the litigation before Judge Baden.
Yes,
and where there's a issue is whether a voluntary remand will be granted. So voluntary remand is not an issue in this case.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct. The case before Judge Baden involves aluminum foil mm-hmm. from Turkey, and Asan is also a mandatory respondent in this case. And in that case, this case involves CAS. And the voluntary remand is not an issue in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Beckwith.
Kyle Beckers for the record. Your Honor, I'm mostly going to echo the points that Asan's counsel made. And the first one is that using the closed IPC is used to calculate the per unit amount, but there's no case that says that per unit amount can't be applied to, the universe of Asan's sales. And in fact, to not apply it to the universe of Asan's sales would be to not grant the full extent of the duty drawback, which the Federal Circuit has held it is required. So the closed IPC is the only thing that's looked at to come up with a per unit amount. But there's no, we're not aware of any case that says that can't be applied to the full universe of sales. In response to the argument that Commerce impermissibly or incorrectly relied on some sort of tracing justification, I think that the point that Commerce is making is that in order to use the methodology proposed by the petitioner, or at least in order to do it in a manner that is consistent with the statute, tracing would be required, because in order to make the denominator all U.S. sales, you would also, like petitioner for Asan said, or excuse me, like counsel for Asan said, you would also have to change the numerator to only apply to inputs that were used for U.S. sales, and that tracing isn't required under the statute. So while the petitioner's methodology in and of itself may not require tracing, in order to do it in a mathematically correct way, which, as petitioner pointed out, is required, tracing would in fact be required. And that's why Commerce's methodology is reasonable here. It applies the full universe of the exempted liabilities of the IPC to the full universe of exports under that closed IPC to come up with a ratio that can then be applied to all of Assan's U.S. sales. If Your Honor has no further questions, we ask that the Court sustain Commerce's remand redetermination.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Herman?
Thank you, Your Honor. So I guess I'd like to do a couple things quickly. First, I'd like to refer you after this argument to page 2 of our affirmative comments on the remand redetermination that was filed with the court on June 30th. It's confidential, but we, in the middle of that page, we discuss Assan's calculation of the drawback, the amount of the drawback adjustment per metric ton. And this is not confidential. The way that adjustment was calculated was it was the amount of duties rebated divided by the volume of sales that were subject to the closed IPC. So that's the basis for calculating the amount of the adjustment. So in reviewing the...
Is there a disagreement about
the
way this is calculated?
No disagreement. And I guess that's where I wanted to go next is, in reviewing the papers for today, it struck me that there's really three things at issue in a drawback adjustment, right? There's the numerator, there's the denominator, and then there's how the amount of the adjustment is applied to the database. With respect to the numerator, as Your Honor just mentioned, we don't really have a dispute. You know, the amount of duties is the amount of duties, and consistent with the statute, it's the amount of duties that was rebated or collected involving subject merchandise exported to the United States subject to a closed IPC. Great. In terms of the denominator, as we've argued, there are two different denominators that the Commerce Department could potentially use: the sales that are subject to the closed IPC, or the sales, all U.S. sales. Now, I think where this becomes relevant is in the application. How does that fraction that's calculated based on the numerator and the denominator get applied? And I guess maybe we've got the specific calculations in our papers, but I think maybe the easiest way to try to address this issue is through a simple example. So, for purposes of the example, let's assume you've got $5 in drawback duties that are at issue. You've got 20 pounds of sales that are subject to a closed IPC, and you've got...
Before you finish this thought,
yeah,
I know that the counsel for the government and for the plaintiff are listening very carefully to this hypothetical.
No.
I may ask you to jump up and respond to it.
Sure.
Yeah.
So $5 in duties, $20 pounds in closed IPC sales, and 100 pounds together, total U.S. sales, not necessarily subject to a closed IPC. So let's say you set the denominator to all U.S. sales. You'd have a $5 adjustment over 100 pounds of total sales, or an adjustment of a nickel. In the similar example, if you rely on the volume of sales subject to a closed IPC, you have a $5 duty drawback over 20 pounds that are subject to a closed IPC, or an adjustment of a quarter per pound. Now, if you take those two fractions, if you apply the 25 per pound adjustment to all total sales of 100 pounds, you get $25 in duty drawback, whereas in the initial facts of the example here, you only have a $5 adjustment. If, however, you apply that 25 cent per pound adjustment to only the 20 pounds that are at issue in the closed IPCs, you get the $5 drawback, which is the amount that is at issue in the numerator. I think that is our fundamental issue here, is there's a disconnect between ASAN's calculation of an adjustment amount that's based on a ratio between the amount of duties rebated and the volume of sales subject to the closed IPC. But then what the Commerce Department does is it applies that higher fraction based on the lower denominator across all U.S. sales, which results in a much larger adjustment that exceeds the volume of drawback that was paid by the Turkish government here. Happy to answer any questions, but that was the fundamental point I wanted to make.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So as part of our, I feel like this is like, you know, Mr. Science or something, and we have a blackboard and various hypotheticals, Mr. Math. So I'll ask Ms. Counsel for the plaintiff just to respond to that hypothetical presented by Mr. Hermit for the defendant.
Thank you, Your Honor. Leah Scarpelli for ASAN. So I am a lawyer after all, so I'm going to stay away from the math of this. But I will say,
step away from it.
I will say the per unit calculation is based on a proportional numerator and denominator, which are both tied to a closed IPC. The fact that that is considered the representative number, that we only use the closed IPC and that's applied to all U.S. sales, is a decision that Commerce made that we don't necessarily agree with. It would be more accurate to use all IPCs and all exports, but that's not the decision that Commerce has made. For the per unit calculation, they only use the closed IPC. In some cases, that might result in a high ratio. In some cases, it might result in a lower ratio than it would be if we used everything. And in some cases, like ICDOSH, it results in there not being a duty drawback adjustment at all because none of the IPCs are closed. So it sort of is the way the cookie crumbles. Sometimes it might help a respondent like ASAN. Sometimes it can really hurt a respondent like ICDOSH that used drawback but didn't get an adjustment at all because we're only using closed IPCs. So when you choose to use closed IPCs as the representative metric for applying the per unit calculation, sometimes the calculation would be different if we used all IPCs. The issue with what Mr. Hermit is trying to do is take a numerator that is based on one IPC and an inflated denominator, which just very, very far reduces the drawback that was actually received. If you want to make the calculation that way, the numerator and the denominator have to be consistent. And the way to make them consistent is to have them both be based on the same number of IPCs. So
thank you.
I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Kyle Becker for the United States. Your Honor, I don't think we disagree with the math that Mr. Hermit did. I think that the central point of disagreement here is that the 100 pounds, the additional 80 pounds, the difference between the 20 and the 100, under Mr. Hermit's result, he's assuming that those additional 80 pounds wouldn't be subject to an IPC. But in our case, we know that all of ASAN's exports were subject to IPCs. They just weren't closed. And so we couldn't use those to calculate the per unit amount, which again, only looking at a closed IPC for that purpose is a proposition that's been sustained by this court. But then that per unit amount applies to the entire universe of ASAN's sales because they were all subject to an IPC and thus would result in liability extinguished for those inputs under those other IPCs. As counsel for ASAN mentioned, there's a possibility that this could result in some cases in a slightly higher duty drawback adjustment or a slightly lower duty drawback adjustment. In most cases, it probably is going to work out right because Commerce is using the consumption ratios under the closed IPC which are unlikely to vary much from IPC to IPC. But in any event, the point is that all 100 pounds, in Mr. Herman's example, if we were going to equate it with our case, would be subject to an IPC, and thus to give the full extent of the duty drawback, you would need to apply the higher ratio to all 100 pounds.
Thank you, John. Now, Mr. Herman, I'll give you one last chance to speak, not more than 2 minutes, regarding the hypothetical.
No, it'll be very quick, Your Honor. So what I would point Your Honor to is the language in the statute that talks about the amount, right? The amount of the duties rebated. Under the hypothetical as I set it up, the way the math should work out is the $5 that's rebated pursuant to a closed IPC, that's the amount. And that's what should be applied based on the language of the statute. You can get there two ways, you know, at least two ways based on the different denominators. But what's important is ultimately is that the amount of the duties that are rebated or not collected is the adjustment that should be made. It can be either a larger adjustment to sales that are just subject to a closed IPC, or it can be a smaller adjustment that's spread across all sales. But under either methodology, you need to come up with an amount that is reflective of the amount of drawback. Let me step back. The amount of the adjustment should be consistent with the amount of duties that's paid by the Turkish government in drawback.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank counsel again for very illuminating arguments. And as I mentioned at the outset, counsel will have the opportunity to file a submission of not more than 2,000 words. It's about eight pages. And that would be due next week, the 31st. And of course, the counsel should also file, and it can be contained within the document that you're going to file on the 31st. Any cases, any citations for cases that have not been appeared previously in your filings? And to the extent that parentheticals would help, that would certainly not be discouraged. And so, again, thank you very much, counsel, and great to see everybody again in the courtroom. And be well, be safe. Till next time.
All rise.
When I say till next time, it doesn't necessarily mean in this case, but you never know. Thank you.
Court stands adjourned.